yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. The show, Alternative Visions, where we focus on the continuing economic and political crises in America and what to do about it, bringing you views from grassroots America and ideas you won't get on the bubblehead talk and TV shows of mainstream media. My guest today is a longtime economics commentator, Greg Godelz. You may have read some of his stuff under his pen name, Zoltan Ziggity. I'll introduce Greg properly in just a moment. To begin, however, I'd like to continue with my show intro commentary and updates on the fiscal cliff, deficit cutting in Washington, or whatever you want to call it, a.k.a. debt ceiling crisis, really austerity American style, evolving and emerging right before our eyes, whatever you want to call it. Remember, January 1st, they settled, as I predicted, right after the November elections they would, in a partial way. My prediction was that there would be three phases. They would come to some partial agreement on January 1st, but then we would have a more substantial debate, discussion, and agreement following January 1st, which we're right in the middle of right now. But the really big deal will come later in the year. Well, on January 1st, if you remember, Obama raised taxes on the rich, as he says, by $600 billion over 10 years, $60 billion a year. Not the 2% he promised, but barely 1%. Got their taxes hiked a little bit, but a pretty good deal for the wealthy. You know, Obama had proposed 1.6 trillion tax hikes on the rich when he started these negotiations, but we know he's not necessarily the best hard bargainer anywhere, always conceding before he has to. And of course, that was reduced to only $600 billion, $60 billion. But you know, the rich Republicans and their rich friends got a pretty good deal out of that first phase. They got all their Bush cuts, tax cuts, the rest of that was not cut, made permanent. That's something they really wanted. And they got big cuts in the estate tax and the alternative minimum tax. Of course, the working class got a $90 billion a year tax hike with the payroll tax being restored to its prior levels. So the working class paid one and a half times as much. Their taxes went up one and a half times as much as the wealthiest 1% in that January deal. Now we're in phase two, with a deadline somewhere in late February, early March, debt ceiling and all that nonsense, right? Where we have $1.2 trillion of all spending, no tax hikes, all spending going to be debated here, spending cuts, that is. Obama says he wants more tax increases. Republicans say, no more. And Obama says he's not going to do this debt ceiling brinkmanship anymore. And Republicans says, oh, yes, you are. Now, if you look at the track record, I think probably the Republicans have a hand up in this next second phase that we're entering now. Although the newspapers are really trying to depict Obama as going to be tough in this next negotiations. Well, I predict $1 trillion in spending cuts in this deal, a reduction in the amount of defense cuts in that whole package, and more social program cuts, and no more tax hikes. I think Obama would give up on that, or maybe a few token loophole closings of, $5-6 billion just to make him look good. But the real negotiations will start right after that, and that will come later this year. That's when they're really going to go after cutting corporate taxes big time. Remember, Obama during the election said he's all for 35% top corporate tax rate, reduce it to 28. Okay, and if you remember, during negotiations in November and December, he offered another $340 billion in Medicare cuts. And in 2011, he had actually offered $700 billion in Medicare cuts. Well, that's still all on the table. And we can expect to see a real targeting of Medicare. In fact, he said so right after the January 2nd deal. He thinks Medicare is the big cause of the deficit. He said so. He gave a real signal to the Republicans, McConnell and Boehner and so forth, that he's willing to really go after Medicare. Now, you don't have to cut Medicare benefits. All you got to do is raise the out-of-pocket costs for everybody, and that's what you're going to see for Part B and Part D, a big increase out-of-pocket cost, I predict. Okay. He also said he likes the idea of reducing the Social Security cost of living adjustment every year, and he likes the idea of raising the eligibility age to 67. So, folks, this isn't over. This austerity American style is just begun. And before this year is over, lots of you are going to be shocked as to what you see coming. All right. So, that's my daily show intro on the fiscal cliff. Ah, let's just call it austerity American style. That's what it's all about, right? They come up with these phony names, fiscal cliff. If you want to read my analysis, I've always said the fiscal cliff was a joke. There was no fiscal cliff. The economic impact of allowing no deal on January 1st would have been quite minimal, and the austerity cutting now is going to be even more significant than any fiscal cliff we could have had. Just go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you'll see every week I had been writing a piece on the fiscal cliff from November through the present. I got another one coming here as to where we are in the second phase. But go to jackrasmus.com, and if you really want to see an in-depth analysis of deficit cutting and the background of deficit cutting, I put on my website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com, Chapter 7 of my book, Obama's Economy, which was entitled Deficit Cutting on a Road to Double-Dip Recession, predicting that if they continue with this austerity in the U.S., and if we have a continued slowdown in the rest of the economy in Europe and Japan, which is happening, we may be headed for a double dip here later this year in early 2014. Well, now that forecast is really quite contrary, isn't it, to what mainstream economists are talking about. So my guest, Greg Goodell's here, nom de plume, Zoltan Zigadi, and I will discuss this topic of about why mainstream economists keep getting it wrong. Okay, Greg is a U.S.-based activist in the communist movement who left the academic world many years ago with a Ph.D. thesis almost finished in philosophy. He writes regularly on his own blog, ZZ's blog. That's two capital ZZ for Zoltan Zigadi. He also writes for Marxism-Leninism Today. You know, we want to get all different views from all kinds of folks here, and I think you'll find Greg has an interesting view. His writings have been published internationally in Cuba, Greece, Italy, Canada, the UK, Argentina, Ireland, Singapore, Ukraine, etc., etc. And he often writes on Marxist political economy and the current global crisis. Welcome, Greg Zoltan.
Thank you, Jack.
Looking forward to our discussion today.
Thank you.
Let's start with a topic, a big topic here. Why do mainstream economists keep getting it wrong? You know, there's three things that people got to remember here. There are 10,000 professional economists in the world, mainstream economists, and in 2008 you could probably count on two hands how many of them really foresaw the crash coming. Well, that's something wrong with their models, I would say. And then we had the recovery in 2009 that they said would happen right away, robustly. We'd snap right back. Well, that didn't happen either, so strike two. And now, if you read some of their, you know, what they're saying about the global economy, there's no explanation why the global economy is slowing down everywhere. Latest data from Germany shows Germany's not growing at all. The EU is tripping country by country into recession. The UK is in a double dip. Japan now is a big problem emerging. And the developing countries, the bigger ones like Brazil, no growth there, almost zero. India, half of what it usually grew. And China usually grew at 10-12%, is now barely growing at 7%. Wow. They have no explanation for this. Greg, what do you think's wrong with these guys?
Well, you did a nice survey. They have gotten it wrong again and again, and I would only dispute that many economists actually predicted or projected the crisis.
I was generous. Right.
But a few of them, Rubini and others, have a track record. But in general, they had a long, long comfort zone in which they established a way of doing economics, very arcane, quantitative, lots of formula. It became a kind of a austere domain that we educated lay people couldn't even go into. We couldn't understand what they were saying. And then, of course, the crisis brought that all tumbling down. So even in journals like the Wall Street Journal, right after the crisis began in earnest, say in September of 2008, they were in a panic. They were talking about Keynes again. They were talking about Minsky. They were talking about even Karl Marx. But now that things have stabilized a little bit, that's all gone and they're back to business. But, you know, I think for most people, most of your listeners, if they just reflect on popular movies, popular entertainments like Inside Job or Too Big to Fail, Margin Call, those movies that depict what happened in 2008 and 2009, and then go to a standard textbook, an economics textbook, they would be shocked to find that there's no answers. I mean, there's really no solution, and I would refer them gladly to your book, Epic Recessions, which has a chapter about the failings of mainstream economists. I think the proof is in the data and what's going on and how they get it all wrong. I think the most recent, really almost laughable moment is last week when Associated Press and Wall Street Journal and other periodicals reported an October report by the IMF in which they literally fell on their knees and said, we got it all wrong. We got the austerity thing all wrong. A quote from an Associated Press article here. Consider it a mea culpa submerged in a deep pool of calculus and regression analysis. The International Monetary Fund's top economist on Thursday acknowledged that the fund blew its forecast for Greece and other European economies because it did not fully understand how government austerity efforts would undermine economic growth. And this takes us to your opening remarks, Jack. They really have long, for a long time projected austerity, cutting back on government budgets and spending on programs, people's programs, and so forth, as an answer to inflation, to all kinds of the ills of the economy. And they proved to be wrong, as you see in Europe today. The economies of Europe today, Germany, for the fourth quarter, they reported that the GDP actually dropped. So another quarter, and they're in recession. And that means the whole EU is in recession, which they've been in for a long time. So they've gotten really radically wrong. Now, how they got it wrong in this case is really instructive. They used in their projections on austerity programs, to justify austerity programs, a multiplier, a Keynesian multiplier, or a reverse multiplier, if you will. And that is, we assume that if you spend a dollar in the economy, Keynes argues this, if you spend a dollar in the economy, that dollar will be spent at the grocers, and the grocer will take the dollar and spend it again and again. And it creates a velocity in the economy, a velocity of the dollars. And that's a multiplier. So when the GDP is calculated, all those dollars are calculated for a year. That's the way it's done. So now with an austerity program, you've got to worry. You've got to concern yourself with how taking money out of the economy will affect negatively, just the reverse. So it's a kind of negative multiplier. And common sense would say, well, if you put a dollar in and it's spent again and again by through different hands to the tune of six times in a year, it's a multiplier of six. And you'd assume if you pulled a dollar out, common sense, it would multiply by six again on the downside. So you'd lose the $6. Ah, but not the IMF. They didn't figure that. They used a multiplier of smaller dimensions on the way down than they used on the way up. And they vastly underestimated it. So they're saying, in effect, that today in Europe, they blundered. They created a situation in which governments are following their plans, the International Monetary Fund plans, which they insist that people follow, the leading lights on this. That's resulted in fact, a decline, economic decline. They didn't anticipate this.
Well, this is a very important point, I think, that you make here. And I raise this, as you said, in my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, which was published in May 2010. And in that book, I argued that the problem with multipliers is that they've collapsed. In other words, remember when Obama came out with his $787 billion stimulus in January 2009?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. The Council of Economic Advisors, economists there, mainstream economists, predicted, well, if you pump $787 billion of stimulus in one end of their black box and you turn the crank, out will come 6 million jobs. Remember that way back
yeah,
then? They were
right.
Predicting 6 million jobs. Now, that was based on a multiplier that reflected historical averages before the crisis. And what I've been saying for some time is that the multipliers aren't behaving like their models claim they would. The spending multiplier, government spending, historically they say it will create 2 to 2.5 times the amount of government spending in the economy. And the tax multiplier will create a little bit less, maybe 1.5 to 2. And of course, spending in that 2009 program was about half of that 787, and taxing was a little less than half. Well, I was arguing that, the spending multiplier is barely 1.25 maybe, and the tax multiplier was not 1.5. Evidence shows it collapsed to 0.35.
Yeah.
So all their assumptions based upon multipliers were nonsense. Why? Because this is not your typical recession. Multipliers decline, given the depth of the recession, this is much deeper, given the rate of decline, much faster, given the phase of the business cycle, and also the type of the business cycle. And this was a finance capital-induced collapse in 2008, and lots of debt overhanging both in businesses and banks and consumers. So the multipliers collapsed. And that's why we haven't got a robust recovery. As I predicted in 2009, we would be bouncing along the bottom for a number of years, and that's exactly what's happened. We still have 22.5 million unemployed.
Yeah, yeah.
You hear them talk about housing. Oh, wow, 7% increase in housing prices. Well, they fell 40%. They got a long way to go.
Well, these ideas that they float, like the multiplier, are contingent. I mean, they're not linked up to the mechanism of a capitalist economy in any profound way. They're really empirical reflections, and they're usually taken from a relatively brief period. And what I admire so much about your work, which is very close to what Marxist work is that you take a long view. You look at historical patterns over long, long periods of time, and if you do that, you would see clearly that something like a multiplier that's distilled from looking at the economy for maybe 10, 20 years is just that. It's just a brief snapshot of the economy for 10 or 20 years. And if you use that going forward and the circumstances change, as you point out, you're in a very profound and deep crisis, it ain't going to work. It's not going to reflect things. But I thought
yes.
The strange thing about the IMF was that they were kind of ahead of themselves. They were kind of putting in what they wanted politically. In other words, their ideology got in the way of science. And they were saying, in effect, you know, we really want austerity programs. They make a lot of sense politically to people that have been trained in our profession, you know, especially with Keynes behind us. You know, we don't think much of Keynes anymore. And so they come up with this idea that's counterintuitive to common sense, that the velocity going down, what you would lose in terms of velocity going down when you cut value out of the economy, is going to be slower than the velocity going up. In other words, you're going to get growth much faster from the multiplier, but you're going to lose very much very quickly from pulling things out of the economy. So that just defies common sense, and you have to justify it. There's an article in London Review of Books this last week, and he uses I've read thoroughly that October report by the IMF, and he said they use the austerity multiplier of 0.5. So for every, this is a quote. So for every £1 billion removed from government spending, GDP would contract to £500 million. The IMF looked at the relevant historical data and concluded that the real multiplier, this is their correction, the real multiplier for austerity-related cuts was higher, in the range of 0.9 to 1.7. So the same package of £1 billion, in fact, removes as much as £1.7 billion of output. So what you have here, then, is that you're really crippling the economy. And this explains in this article, London Review of Books, why the austerity program they've imposed in England actually has not reduced the deficit at all. It remains roughly the same as it was when they started the program, when the new government started the program. Why? Because you're destroying the economy so quickly that the percentage of the deficit, the percentage of government spending beyond what it takes in, remains the same because the economy is shrinking. And this is what the IMF missed. And that's really like astronomers missing the fact that an asteroid is going to hit the Earth. It's of that dimension. I mean, it's a huge, huge mistake on their part. It's not really a mistake. It's ideology.
Well, clearly, austerity is not working anywhere, and we're embarking upon that same road right now in the U.S. Let's take a brief break and come back, and let's talk about, well, if it's not working, why are they pushing it? Why austerity if it's clearly not working? What's the purpose? Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. We're going to take a quick break here. We're a little over the schedule, but we'll be right back.
Now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming. I can see the light. I'm a jack of all trades.
This is Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. My guest, Zoltan Ziggity, here, and we're talking about why economists got it so wrong and continue to get it wrong. And the topic is austerity. Austerity, of course, means let's cut spending and let's make the middle class and working class pay for the deficits that were created during the crisis and even before the crisis in the case of the U.S., you know. We've been running huge deficits ever since George W. Bush, and mostly, largely, if you look at it, because of the Bush tax cuts benefiting investors, over $3 trillion since 2001, and the wars, over $2 trillion. And then, of course, runaway health care costs and so forth. You can read an article on my blog that really identifies what are the real causes of deficits and debt. The eight real causes of deficits and debt. Just go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, several months ago, and it's also in my book, Obama's Economy, earlier this year. Austerity, meaning, to me, it's pretty clear what austerity policies mean is, big corporations and capitalists caused this crisis, but you, the folks, the people, are going to have to pay for it. If you look at strategies across the globe, in Europe and U.S. and so forth, it's bail out the banks with free money. In other words, just push all this free money, they call it quantitative easing, at the banks, fill up their black hole. And it is free money, folks. You know, it costs a quarter of 1% to borrow if you're a bank from the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve will then pay you interest for borrowing. So they're actually going to pay you to take free money. Or they'll go out and they'll buy your junky bonds at near market prices to the tune of trillions of dollars. So the banks get bailed out not by the government, but by the central bank. And the deficits for the other bailouts and the lack of economic growth, well, the people pay for that. And capitalists say, well, let's just hold tight with this approach and wait for things to improve. That's essentially their strategy. I don't know. You want to comment on that, Greg?
Yeah, I don't. You know, the left, historically the left and more radical elements in the labor movement have always seen a crisis like this as an opportunity to make some serious changes. If we looked at the Great Depression as a counterpart, we would say, hey, there was an opportunity there to fundamentally change capitalism in a way that more favorable. I mean, really, the balance of forces between working people and the capitalists changed in that period. They were able to enact that because of the severity. Well, this is similarly severe, and yet the people taking the opportunity or grabbing the opportunity here are not the left. They're not the labor movement. They're the right, and they're the neoliberals. And I include the Democratic Party, most of the Democratic Party in that. And they seize the opportunity, and austerity is really just that. It's a seizure of an opportunity to make some marked changes in the way things are done in the regime. And that's what they've done by imposing austerity here and in Europe and in other places. They see that as an opportunity, and they use the financial sector very, very shrewdly. In other words, this whole issue of interest rates and so forth and the various ratings of these countries, the Fitch and Standard & Poor's and so on, these are instruments, these are weapons against working people. So that's essentially what's going on. I think we have to always keep in mind one glaring fact, and that is you cannot think of government spending on the analogy of household spending. It's just a fallacy. It's called the fallacy of composition and logic. But you cannot liken it the same way. I mean, so many people are really mesmerized by this notion that, oh, we're spending more than we're pulling in. We're building up, we have a deficit. We're building up our national debt. It really isn't a problem or an issue. It's not the same kind of thing as when I go out and go crazy with my credit card. It's not like that at all. So it's really a false notion, but it is an opportunity, and it's been used as an opportunity for both of our political parties who join in on this kind of orgy. They just have different views on how much they can take away from working people, but they both agree to take away from working people in this instance. This is an opportunity they've seized. And we on the left in the labor movement, even left-center folks, we missed the opportunity. It really changed capitalism. I remember, as I said early in our discussion, I recall the Wall Street Journal in 2008-2009. I was shocked. They're talking about Keynes again. They're talking about Minsky and even Marx. I mean, the desperation was the same desperation the banks had in 1932-33 when they invited FDR to nationalize the banks, and he chose not to go that far. So, I mean, we have only ourselves to blame if we don't fight back, because it really is, as Jack's pointed this out again and again, but it really is a false alarm.
Yeah, this austerity is like a code word for balancing the budget, right? Or reducing the deficit to try to get more to a balanced budget. And the argument is that, oh, if we balance the budget or reduce, approach it by reducing spending, that will generate business confidence. You know, the problem is, oh, business is not confident about investing, and therefore we have to reduce the deficit, and then they'll become confident, and then they will invest. Well, we've given business over $2 trillion in the U.S. in tax cuts, $2 trillion in tax cuts and subsidies and profit, subsidies and so forth, and they're just sitting on it. They're sitting on a cash hoard, big business, of $2 trillion, and they're not investing.
It just goes up and up and up. I mean, it's not just a hoard.
Yeah.
It's a growing hoard.
Yes, a growing hoard. How much more we got to give them before they actually create jobs in the U.S.? My argument is they're not interested in creating jobs in the U.S. anymore. They're interested in creating jobs elsewhere in the world, and they're interested in investing in financial securities more than they are interested in creating jobs that make things in the U.S. And, Greg, that's one of the big shortcomings of mainstream economics. all their models, all these economists, and I know because I read their textbooks and I read their articles and so forth, they don't understand the nature of the financial crisis. There's no financial variables in their models. All these models are based upon non-financial data and non-financial variables. Well, no wonder they can't predict. If they don't know the relationship between financial cycles and real non-financial cycles, and how now they are overlapping more than ever and exacerbating each other.
Yeah, again, Epic Recessions has some charts that I recall that are really quite useful in terms of where debt lies, in fact. And, you know, corporate debt is never a bother. Is that ever a problem? I mean, you know, the vacillations when it goes up dramatically, when it comes down, does that create a problem in which we have to act upon it? Does consumer debt, I mean, I think it does, but I mean, in the minds of policymakers, does consumer debt bother them? Not at all. It's only government debt that bothers them. And yet, that's often far outweighed by other forms of debt. It's really kind of a shell game. I mean, it's really an opportunity for them. That's why it's political economy and not economics. I think when people start believing in economics departments and as opposed to political economic or political economy, they really are showing their colors, because it's politics. It's really, you can never get away from the human element that's involved in economics. It's not just a function of markets. Markets are just a shorthand for relationships between people. That's the fundamental point that Marx makes.
Well, you're absolutely correct about this debt question. If you go back and you look at, and there are charts in my book, if you look at the increase in total debt, in other words, not just government debt, but consumer debt and corporate debt, both financial and non-financial corporate debt, from 2000 until 2008, when the crisis erupted, the huge increase was in corporate debt, particularly financial debt, and consumer debt to a little extent, and, you know, federal government debt, because we made all these big tax cuts for the rich, and we financed these wars without paying for them. Mm-hmm. But the real problem, way outweighing government debt, was corporate debt. And, you know, Greg, corporations, particularly small and medium corporations, are piling on even more and more debt. Junk bonds,
mm-hmm.
record
yeah.
boom in junk bonds. At some point, they're going to have to refinance those junk bonds.
That's right.
If interest rates are up, a lot of these companies are going to go under.
Well, I think we share a certain model here, if you want to call it a model. But going back to your point about cash and the accumulation of cash and this growing pool of cash, it reminds me, which is spelled out in your book, and you know it's in my writing as well, that's the kind of incipient conditions for further crisis, because capitalism, when it accumulates that much surplus, that much cash value, assets, has to find a place to invest it. And junk bonds is one place that they invest in. Another place, of course, are derivatives and so on and so forth. It tends to, because there aren't productive ways to invest, particularly with no jobs, no increase, really a long-term prospect of increase in consumption or any revolutionizing of consumption in the future going forward, they look to the financial sector. And going back to your point, it's the financial sector that then becomes the key to crisis. It's the place where the conditions for crisis emanate, where they really fester and grow, and then they come forward. And with this accumulation of cash and corporations and assets, I think it's inevitable that crisis will not only continue but worsen. Capitalism must find a place to invest.
Absolutely. If you look at what's happened since 2000, one of my arguments is that more and more money capital is flowing into financial instruments, derivatives, and so forth, which means there's less and less to finance real investment, and those real job-creating investment in the U.S. And the result is we have no job growth in the U.S. People aren't aware that the labor force, the number of jobs in the U.S., is no greater today than it was in 2001. We're in the same place. There's been no growth for 12 years of jobs in the U.S. because we're not investing in real things, and the capitalists are turning more and more to quick profits on financial instruments and so forth. And that's causing a slowing down of the real growth rate in the United States. And when that happens, when you get another financial crisis, the real economy gets even worse. And you can see that with consumers as well. Mm-hmm. How are we getting consumption? Just look at the consumption, 70% of the economy. What's driving consumption? It's not real income. No. Real incomes for the median family are declining 1% to 2% per year.
Mm-hmm.
How are they doing this? They're adding more credit and debt. That's how they're doing it.
It's sort of paradoxical because they reduce their debt because they can refinance on major items. But they're incurring more debt on their credit cards and schools, things like that. You know, their kids going to school, the American consumers. So,
student
but
debt,
it's debt that's driving it. You're absolutely right. It's debt that keeps consumption alive. And without that, it would collapse. It would really collapse.
You know, but when you get a downturn and all your consumption is debt and credit driven, or most of it, much of it, then you get even a sharper, deeper decline when you hit another business cycle downturn. And I predict that's what's coming.
Yes, and that's a real multiplier. I mean, that's a kind of unspoken and unquantified multiplier in terms of how these things get worse and worse and how they feed on each other. You know, one of the things that scares me, Jack, is for the first time, I mean, this is perhaps promising for the job situation, but devastating for incomes and for working people. As for the first time, you know, union industries like the auto industry, UAW auto industry, actually the non-union shops in the South are reducing their pay and their benefit packages, non-union, because they can, because the UAW contracts are so bad. And the concessions are so great that they feel compelled now to compete to reduce their own packages. I mean, so it's feeding on itself. And how can you organize working people to fight back when you have that kind of situation?
Yeah, it's not much a record for joining the union, is it?
No, it's exactly.
You know, there's a lot of hullabaloo about during the election, if you recall, Obama saying, the auto industry has been brought back, and so forth. You know, we've got 150,000 jobs in auto. Well, people don't realize they lost 340,000.
Yeah,
and they got 150 back, and a lot of the 150 is at a two-tier lower wage, $13 an hour.
Yeah, that's right. The two-tier system now is a $13, $14 an hour startup.
Yeah.
It started at GM, and now it's at Ford as well, and it'll be at Chrysler as well. You know, during the crisis, Sarkozy, just to show you where our politics are, Sarkozy...
he's the president of France, or was, right?
Yeah, the former president of France, conservative, very conservative. He pledged, because of pressure from the labor movement, that Renault and Peugeot would not get bailouts unless they maintain the workforce. In this country, our president would not give the bailouts unless they promised to close plants.
Yeah.
That's where we are. I mean, that's a pretty shocking admission of where we are. And I think people have to look at this. They have to look at the way the world is shaped and what's going on in other parts of the world to really understand how bleak things are here politically. We really have to make changes. We have to find new solutions going forward and not turn to mainstream economists for answers.
I think we need to take one more break before the end of the show here, and then we'll come back and let's talk more about what's happening to the American consumer. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. A brief break, and my guest and I will return.
And you learn to make do. You take the old. You make it new. If I had me a gun, I'd find the bastards and shoot them on sight. I'm a jack of all trades. We'll be alright. I'm a jack of all trades.
my guest, Greg Goodell, a.k.a. Zoltan Ziggity, and we're talking about why mainstream economists keep getting it wrong. And some of the topics, just to recap, we talked about how they misestimate the multipliers, a big problem, how they have no way of accounting in their models, in their forecasts for financial variables. And, Greg, you raise the point of they are often themselves victims of their own ideology, economic ideology rather than economic science. What do we mean by ideology? Well, to me, that simply means falsifying reality for political interests and economic purposes of gain for certain groupings. Yeah.
You know, fundamentally, mainstream economists try to reduce all economic activity to the motives of rational choices of individuals. That is, they don't allow for any kind of uniqueness to collective action, collectivity in the economy. So they tend to try to make everything flow around a certain kind of individual greed, and that's what motivates and moves an economy. But capitalism is more than just that. It's more than just the individual operators, and they become clouded because they view the world in just this fashion. That's an ideological premise, and it's only grown with the rise of neoclassical, neoliberal economics and the departure from Keynes. So today, you're looking at really political economy. If you strip away all the formula, if you strip away all the charts, you're looking at really Adam Smith and Hobbes. You're looking at that kind of state of nature view of how capitalism operates. And I think it's flawed. I mean, I think it's just fundamentally flawed. So it's not just missing the crisis. The crisis is like the Wizard of Oz. The crisis is the moment where Toto pulls the curtain back and you see just how they operate and how they function. And it ain't very impressive. It really isn't very impressive. You know, I guess the leading light among liberals would be Paul Krugman. And I find it interesting. Certainly, a lot of the things he says is very, very good. And the notion that we should be spending money rather than embarking on austerity programs is right on spot on. The problem, of course, is that he doesn't mention what Jack mentioned, and that is spending is not just spending. There's war Keynesianism. They're spending on wars. I mean, we could actually spend a hell of a lot more if we go to war in Africa, join the French in Mali. But that's not what political economy should be about. It should really emanate from people's needs, people's wants, from the collective will of our people. It should be very democratic. There's no room for that in mainstream economics.
Yeah, you know, just to give the listeners a couple of examples of what I consider ideology, economic ideology, that people tend to just accept, but which the facts and data don't support. One very typical ideological proposition is austerity is needed for business confidence, that only with austerity business confidence will return and therefore investment, they will invest and therefore jobs and recovery. Another related ideological proposition is tax cuts create jobs. Another is, you got to reduce business cost and regulation, reduce interest rates, reduce wages, and this will create jobs. Or free trade benefits all. All of those examples, and there's many more, are just not supported by empirical fact. And, you know, we won't get into showing the empirical evidence, but, you know, this parades as economics. And it's taught in the, you know, in the economics textbooks, you know, when I teach students, unfortunately, all the economic textbooks say a lot of the same stuff, and to unteach them.
Sure, and if people were just honest about it, I mean, I'm honest about my biases and my prejudices and my ideology. I mean, I don't think you'd escape ideology. We all have ideologies. But you have to be kind of candid about it and say, this is what I believe. Now, if you don't believe it, show me I'm wrong. But to pretend that those are laws of nature is just absurd. I mean, it's just a shell game. It's just pulling the wool over people's eyes. So, but that's, you know, we don't have, thankfully, we have radio shows like yours, Jack, and alternative media. But in general, we don't have a response to a megaphone to respond to these kind of things very often. and we need to have those megaphones.
Let's talk about the U.S. consumer a little bit here in the last five minutes or so. You know, consumption is 71% of the U.S. economy, and consumption can't seem to get going. We got stop-go, like in so many other parts of the economy, whether it's housing or jobs and so forth. Why do you think you're not going to get a recovery without consumption recovering, and if you're relying on credit, which is happening more and more once again, and building up debt, as I've argued in my books, you know, the key thing to understanding why we can't get a recovery is this relationship between income and debt. If you still have very high levels of debt and your income is not growing and falling, which is the case for the great median of consumer households in this country, it's falling 1% to 2% per year here for 5 years and even before that, and now we're consuming based upon they're throwing credit cards at us again and we're refinancing our house. Well, this is the same problem we had before. There's no fundamental change until you get real disposable incomes of households, of middle-class households, growing once again.
I agree, and I think you have to step back from some of our other comments and see and recognize that the real fundamental cause of the crisis fundamentally is income disparity, income and wealth disparity, and the growth of that since 1972. That's a big reason that the elite, the 1%, have accumulated this enormous pool of capital, which seeks out investment, seeks it out in the financial sector, seeks it out with derivatives and other bizarre, crazy, risky phenomena, and drive us into crisis. And so we have to try to restore some kind of a balance. I mean, in my view, as a Marxist, we have to kind of depose those folks. But short of that, we have to find a new balance where the majority of people have much more of the income, whether through taxes or, you know, it's so bizarre, Jack, that we have the example of the Great Depression, and I know you studied it, others have studied it, but when you didn't look at it, if you just look at it casually, you see all these tools and instruments that are available to us that grew out of the experimentation of the Great Depression that could restore a better balance, create a new equilibrium, a new relationship between capital and labor. No one wants to talk about it. And we don't have within our political apparatus and our two-party system, we don't have any advocates for that. We have no one advocating going back and looking at the Great Depression and saying, what mechanisms can we create here to restore a balance between labor and or create a better relationship between labor and capital? And that's the only answer, in my view. I don't think it's going to be done by increasing the military budget or even some of the infrastructure programs, given that they go into the private sector. So.
Well, that was one of my criticisms of Obama's programs, that the infrastructure spending was very long-term and very capital-intensive, didn't create a lot of jobs. We've only spent half of the $100 billion that was allocated 3 years ago. You can't create jobs that way, and nor do you create jobs when you simply give subsidies to the states. That might prevent layoffs occurring and things getting worse, but it doesn't make things better. And then when you give tax cuts to the rich and the corporations and they sit on and hoard it, well, that was Obama's program, and that's why we never got a robust recovery.
Well, it wasn't the WPA, that's for sure, and rather than a WPA, it put all the infrastructure money into private developers and construction companies, which assigns a huge amount of money to profit. And if you were a construction company and you got one of the contracts for the infrastructure, if I did, let's say I did, you know, if you're a capitalist, the first thing you think about is how can I keep more of this money for myself? Well, one way is not to hire too many people, just work the workers I have over time and minimize the my cost of labor. So there were no jobs created, and there's virtually no jobs created around that. I'm talking out of my hat, but I mean there weren't very many jobs created around that.
Well,
because it went through the private sector, unlike the WPA.
Right.
That created jobs.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's a fact here, listeners. We've created 4 million jobs in the first term, but we've have just about the same number of people who left the labor force or aren't getting counted. So it's like a churning. That's why we still have 23 million unemployed in this country, effectively. And also, if you look at what were the wages of the jobs created compared to the wages of the jobs lost, very interesting report came out not too long ago, last November. 60% of the jobs lost during the recession were high-tier jobs, high-tier paying jobs, construction, manufacturing jobs. In other words, jobs paying over $20 an hour. Okay? Of the jobs that have been created, 58% have been low-tier jobs, $7 to $12 an hour. So we lost all these high-paying jobs, and we replaced them under Obama with low-paying jobs, and guess what? The average wage declines as a result.
Sure.
It's and you know, they're low-paying because a lot of them are temporary jobs and involuntary part-time jobs.
It's changed the labor market entirely. I mean, it's really changed. It's reshaped the way working America is today. And why would you expect labor to be stronger as a result of that? It actually weakens labor. I mean, the government policies, the Obama policies actually weaken labor. Not that they've ever done anything for labor in this period, but this actually, their policies actually weaken labor.
Well, why do they, the AFL-CIO, change the wind top leadership, continue then to support Obama and the Democrats? If they haven't done anything for him, and if things are getting worse for him, what's your explanation of why?
Well, fundamentally,
he's still in his cap.
Yeah, fundamentally, I think it goes back to the Cold War. I think that the labor movement was really harmed greatly by the anti-communism, which drove most of the left people, not just communists, but the left, out of the labor movement. And so today, you've got some good people. I mean, Trump and others that are good people, but they just don't have the wherewithal or the understanding. Or they have people around them that are urging them to take any kind of radical action. I mean, the Republicans understand this logic. They understand the logic of, look, if you want our support, you got to give us something. They understand that. But the labor movement won't do that. I mean, they're just happy to have access, to be able to go to the Oval Office once in a while and have a beer with Obama. They make no demands. And it's got to change, and in my view, it's got to change probably from the rank and file, because I don't really see the top leadership. Even I know a lot of left-wing friends of mine who are staff people in the labor movement and so on. They're really good people, but they're caught up in the same logic. You know, they've got good incomes. They're not going to rock the boat. So we need rank and file movements, I think. I think we need to get people moving on the grassroots level in the labor movement. And we need the labor movement. That's the only way we'll make progress. Do you agree with that, Jack?
Well, absolutely. You know, if you look at Occupy, which has raised a number of very important points and made some significant contributions, the fact is they just lack the organizational weight to be able to really do something. The labor movement has the organizational potential. But as you said, more and more of the leadership, I think, was content with being a big fish in a declining pond.
Yeah.
Rather than growing the pond, you know?
Well, I mean, all I can see is trying to get some reconciled movement. Some things came out of the UAW, you know, during this whole process. There were some shop floor initiatives and so on, and that's all encouraging, and hopefully there'll be more.
Well, Greg, we have to talk more in the future about the global economy, and I hope to have you back at some time. We can talk about the Eurozone, seems you know something about that. Thanks for coming on, and we will continue this view with grassroots folks of why the economy is not really recovering, what's wrong with economics here on a continual basis. Okay, so this is Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus. We'll see you next week. We'll talk about, is there really a housing recovery going on?